In the last years of the 1940s, George Adamski was one of the very first people to publicly reveal his encounters and his experiences relating to the UFO phenomenon. Through his devotion, courage to speak about this, a lot of people became aware of the existence of extraterrestrial life. Who was this man? George Adamski. In a moment, we'll talk with an expert, Colin Bennett, about all things UFOs on Coast to Coast. Colin Bennett has devoted his time to scholarship, occasionally lecturing, researching, reading, and writing of books. He is also currently working on a book on Lee Harvey Oswald. Colin attended Holcroft School and then the Balliol College in Oxford University, where he received a BA in English Language and Literature. He has also been a musician, mercenary soldier, university lecturer, and journalist, and he's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Colin. How are you?
Hi, yes. Good morning, George. Thank you for your invitation to speak.
So you've gone from being a musician to a mercenary soldier? How did that happen?
Oh, these were the follies of youth. that's how I describe them now. The mercenary bit was for a very short time, for 6 months. And it was a youthful adventure. My values have changed somewhat.
Well, it happens. Thank goodness. It happens when we age, Colin, I guess, to all of us, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes I wonder, though, if my youth was probably more correct than my aged process. I'm not sure anymore.
I thought indeed, sir.
How did you get interested in the subject of UFOs? With this kind of background, musician, mercenary soldier, university lecturer, journalist, how did this all happen?
Well, there's nothing more fascinating than UFOs, flying saucers, as they used to be called. They bring in just about every area of human thinking and endeavor you can think of. They're not isolated or into things. From the end of 1945, the UFOs developed in two broad streams, which brought in just about everything in our culture. They developed in the scientific sense, so that the Air Force, the United States Air Force, and just about every other Air Force was interested in them, and scientists were interested in them. They were baffled by them. The other side of the picture is the true believers, the ones who were not in the Air Force, who were not scientists, and who said that they had met space beings, and these were great teachers, sort of religio-metaphysical teachers. Of course, the two sides were opposed, but these two raging debates took flight, and it brought in very, very interesting areas concerning human beings, concerning the culture we live in, concerning technology. There isn't a thing that ufology and either the scientific side or the metaphysical belief side hasn't touched on. So you've got a big fat subject there. And I was fascinated by this range of human responses to it. Attempts by well-meaning Air Force intelligence officers, by scientists, to try and focus the phenomenon, which usually failed. And the idea of that failure is very interesting in itself. What Eisner called originally the industrial military complex turned its head towards the UFO. And while it was highly organized on most things, it wasn't highly organized as regard to focusing flying saucers. Committees were formed of very doubtful scientists, and they reached negative conclusions. For the most part, people were confused. They had high imaginations. They had taken in too much media. And what they saw in the sky, these mysterious objects, were illusions, fantasies. And there was no point in the... we're talking about the American Air Force here, chiefly. There's no point in the Air Force pursuing the investigation. The trouble with that decision was that, as today, the input of sightings was terrific, and it ranged over the whole of society. Airline pilots would report them, fighter pilots would report them. And the very interesting and often comic thing is that the Air Force struggled, might and main, to try and get rid of the reports which were coming in.
Try as they may, they couldn't succeed.
So we have a very interesting public relations situation regarding the military, regarding the intellectuals, regarding the scientists. They had a ball of fire thrown to them, and they didn't know what was going off.
Did they create a two-tiered level?
The other side of the picture, the true believers, they just carried on as they always carried on, not caring about what anybody thought. You know, the UFO visitors were angels or whatever you call it. They described it in religious terms. So you have these two sides of the UFO or flying saucer phenomenon. You have the true believers, and you have the scientists in a desperate muddle.
Colin, was there a two-tiered level here?
The maneuvering of the scientific community, according to mainstream cultural propaganda, the scientific community is supposed to be very, very fair-minded and objective. And as regards the UFO, it was plunged into a veritable snake pit of accusations and denials. This was very early on, straight after the war. And so that's the broad, the two main streams of ufological development, if you like.
All right, now tell me, was there a two-tiered level where government was hiding everything, but at the same time they actually were not confused, but they were doing this thing under the table?
The silver discs, flipping, as he described it, rather like flat stones on a pond. And he got back to base, and he was civilian. And he was besieged by reporters, and he said, well, what are they like? What are they like? And he said, well, they're just like saucers. And it took off from there, the term.
Now, the
investigators. Am I still online?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm getting a little feedback, so I don't know if you are hearing me when I'm.
No, that's fine. That's fine. There was just a silence there, so I thought I'd check with you.
Okay. The investigations into this entire phenomenon, it started some time ago, but my question was government actually conducting clandestine research while publicly telling all of us there's nothing going on?
Well, as the conferences concerning, just let me say something here. As far as the Air Force was concerned, the military investigation was based on ATIC, the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson. That was the hub of the American UFO military Air Force UFO investigation. At conferences, I've scanned the conferences with the Pentagon connecting ATIC, and there are always, I'm trying to answer your question, you see, there are always civilians present. There was, and these civilians are very mysterious. They're representatives of the aircraft industry. Michael Brewster was chief man that was concerned here. I think the Brewster name was the name of the aircraft company, defunct. I think they built the Brewster Buffalo, which was of mixed reputation in World War II. And they have, the civilians, they have much more information than Air Technical Intelligence. They've done their homework and their measurements and their studies, and they're bringing this into the military conference field. So the military conference and its the discussions were quite well known. They're well documented, and we can buy books about them. But the civilian side is less known. So I would say that there was a covert civilian interest. They're much faster than the military. They know their stuff, and they're doing work. But what framework that civilian element represents is a question mark. So, in other words, there were other elements. If you just take the air technical intelligence assessments, that's one thing. But the civilian involvement is mysterious.
Well, Colin, let's talk about George Adamski now. Then here's a case. Here's a guy in the 40s. Who went public and revealed his encounters. Was he serious? Was he nuts? What was going on with this guy?
Well, of course, ever since biblical times, people have lived in deserts and seen elemental beings. I mean, that's the first thing I'll say. It's part of our culture, yeah. The Bible's based on it. The Muslim religion is based on it. They see elemental creatures, and these elemental creatures, they call them God or gods, form part of this amazingly powerful culture. Do you agree there that they do that? So that's the historical background. It's a powerful thing. You can dismiss it. You can say it's nonsense. You can say these people are mad, but people do meet elemental beings throughout the whole of history, and these meetings with elemental beings, whatever they are, form part of our entire moral and intellectual cosmos. Okay, so that's the background. So people do meet these people, these claim to meet these people.
Beings, yeah.
And so you have here an analogy then. You have the young George Adamski, who was a very, very Christian man, and he toiled, broke virgin land on the slopes of Mount Palomar with his own hands in a kind of prototypal hippie community during the Second World War, and grew his own vegetables, etc. I don't think you get many smooth imposters doing that kind of
thing. No.
Choosing that kind of horny-handed hard life, because life in Second World War on the slopes of Mount Palomar was not lush. And he claimed that that he saw a flying saucer, a typical disc-shaped vehicle, land in the desert. He was with four other people, and he approached the vehicle, and he saw a being, a humanoid being, man looked like a man, and he, by sign language and by what he called telepathy, he communicated with the man who said he was a visitor from Venus. Now, you're not on a great meritocratic streak if you claim you've met a man from Venus.
No.
You bring down the whole world on his shoulders. And it's a very silly thing to do. But he did it. It would appear to be. But then, of course, you have the Bible. And if you made biblical claims now, you would be regarded as being equally as silly. I think that the major historical background there is the thing to bear in mind when you just say, oh, silly, stupid, insane, mentally ill, sick, and so on and so forth. Is there the Bible and the great books of the world are based on such things? And it's up to you to have a look at that in perspective. And he said that this was an advanced being, very, very sort of well-meaning and so on. He got the impression. And the being, he was later called Orthon by the editor of Adamski's books, because he had to have a name, as it were. He didn't introduce himself as Orthon. The vehicle took off. Orthon re-entered the vehicle. The vehicle took off, and there were four other witnesses to this. This is Adamski's story. It's called The Desert Contact. And there you are. And just one strand of this is true in the full and proper sense. Then we're living in a much bigger world than we have hitherto conceived.
Now, we didn't have television during those days, Colin, so what kind of publicity did he generate? I mean, did he get newspaper articles that were written about him?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. He was a figure of very great interest. He was a very, very, fundamentally, he was a very, very nice man. There's no hint of corruption of any kind, no sexual scandals. I think he got a bit confused as he got older. But then we all do, perhaps. But he wrote a book about this experience. The Flying Saucers Have Landed. What a wonderful roseate title that is.
Sure.
With a Britisher, Desmond Leslie. And the book was an immediate bestseller, a worldwide success, one of the best-selling books in the post-war period. And Adamski became very famous. He was invited to speak all over the place. And I did a world tour, yeah, with the trumpets.
So did some people believe him?
Well, they did, yes. They did believe him, yeah. And that's a fantastic story, yes. Well, this book is a classic. It's still being bought, and the Desmond Leslie part to it was part of it making a bestseller. What Desmond Leslie was a scholar. He had not had a UFO experience in the physical sense. Excuse me. He'd not had a physical experience, but he was a great scholar, and he wrote the first part of the book, which described UFOs throughout history. Christopher Columbus saw a UFO, for example. It was a light in the sky just before he made landfall. Alexander the Great saw one, and several other the famous people of history. And he wove these stories through history and showed that people were seeing UFOs in history and having contacts with elemental beings in one form or another in history. That's the first part of the book. The second part of the book was George Adamski's actual physical experience. So the structure of the book was very strong because you've got this historical thing moving forward to the present day and then joining George Adamski's experience for real. And it was a powerful basis for the book.
He also had some incredible photographs at a time where we didn't have computers to manipulate pictures.
This is one of the problems when you criticize George Adamski. Yeah, he took these photographs, and they've never been proved to be fake. They're the classic UFO photographs. I mean, even five-year-olds know what an Adamski scout ship looks like. They've been modeled a million and one times, you know, from very early science fiction films to Star Trek. They're an upturned saucer with a globe on the top. And this is the strange thing. Independent of Adamski, such forms have been described. You know, so Adamski was very early on with this. Now, we're talking about the very early 50s. And so there you are, and you pay your money and you take your choice. There's very strong evidence that he had a very incredible experience.
What kind of a man did he die, Colin? Was he happy upon his death? Was he shunned? What happened upon his death?
He was not particularly happy. No, he wasn't. He started off. He was a very happy man as a youth. He was a very happy man, and prosperous man, and famous man, a man of achievement in his middle age. And here we have. Then something happened. It's a kind of tale that Joseph Conrad would have dealt with in a story. The story itself of the desert contact with Orthon had to be expanded in his mind. So it's my opinion, I've written a book on this, so it's my opinion that he started to create episodes. Yeah. I think the original experience was real. That's my opinion. And then he started to extend the soaps.
Then he got carried away.
Which is psychologically very interesting. That, you know, the story was so thin.
All right, Colin, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break here. Then we're going to come right back and continue talking with you. Of course, Colin's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's also written a book called American Demonology. We're going to talk with him about that when we come back as well. If you need to email me, that's very simple. It's george@coasttocoastam.com. So hold on. When we come right back, we're going back live to the United Kingdom with our guest Colin Bennett right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, get ready for some of your UFO questions because we're going to have an opportunity to chat with Colin Bennett about that. But when we come right back, we'll talk with him more about this fascinating book that he's written called American Demonology. What does that mean? And also Project Blue Book. You know, we've heard a lot about it, but what really was going on behind the scenes? That's next. On Coast to Coast AM. Lots to talk about. Colin, I'm fascinated with your work in research into our Project Blue Book. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? And you know, we all know publicly the outcome, but not a lot of people understand that the man who was in charge of it at the time, Captain Ruppelt, I think he ended up really believing in UFOs, didn't he?
He was a very disappointed and rather compromised man towards the end of his life. Unfortunately, he died rather young. And he was very frustrated because the Air Force wouldn't listen to him. And they put pressure on him to downplay the subject. And I mean, when you've devoted your life to a thing and you have these big authorities trying to put you down and put heavy pressure on you, you become depressed. And naturally. And he wasn't a very happy man, but he had a heart condition too, which didn't make matters, which made matters far worse. So in answer to your question, no, he didn't die a happy man. But he was a very great man in his way. He wrote one of the great books about the inside of the military-industrial complex. Books about the military, really good books about the military and technology from the inside. Are quite rare. He was a good writer. The book is his book is called. He wrote one book. His book is called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. And he wrote this book after he left the Air Force, and it was published in 1956. It became quite a good seller, and then of course he was free to, as a civilian, to tell you about himself and the project. The Air Force didn't like it. It was pro-UFO. He was also critical of the Air Force in many ways, in its application and its concentration and its intelligence levels. I mean, with intelligence with a capital I and intelligence with a small I. And the Air Force, it was not good propaganda for the United States Air Force. In any respect.
There were two people.
In a social respect, it was not good. And in a much deeper respect, it cast a very, very nasty light on the ability of the Air Force to analyze situations. Not only that, it criticized the tactical readiness of the Air Force in very, very harsh terms. These criticisms were leveled when he was head of Project Blue Book from 52 onwards. And this was the Project Blue Book was the official United States Air Force research project into the UFO phenomenon. The Air Force was so worried about it, they formed this project and they put Ruppelt at head of it. There had been other projects, but they were useless. And it was decided to have a new broom. He was a very bright guy. A very deep thinker. And, of course, when you're a bright guy and a very deep thinker within a corporate organization, you can have problems, particularly if they're involved with alien contact.
Yeah, and he had his problems, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, they did. They did. They wouldn't. They hobbled him, if you know what I mean. They didn't give him the right facilities. They didn't back him up, although he was there. He was their official representative. He could have had a lot more resources. He only had two or three staff, I think five at maximum. And he was chasing all over the place, all over America, to gather reports about these incredible experiences people were having, from policemen to housewives to pilots and Air Force fighter pilots themselves. It was raw material. It was coming in rapidly. But you have this amazing... This is what makes this whole subject very interesting. This organization, Air Force, which is basically scientific and technological, they're just panicking. And they're trying to stop it. They don't know what to do. It's showing them in a bad light as far as technical intelligence is concerned. They're not quick enough. They don't know what they're doing. Whereas in every other concrete realm, the Air Force is fine. In this realm, they're hopeless. And he reveals that in his book. And it all comes to a head when he gets a telephone call in the mid-July 52. They're over Washington. The lights are over Washington.
All over Washington.
All over Washington, yeah. And he revealed a complete kind of Pearl Harbor situation. As you know, Washington at that time had three airports, the National Airport, Bolling, and Andrews Air Force Base. It so happened that Repairs were being carried out at Andrews Air Force Base and at Boeing, and there wasn't a single fighter there, an F-94 in those days, to cover the damn capital of the most powerful nation in the world, in which the president was asleep, for God's sake. And at one point, the panic is such that President Truman asks his Air Force representative, not chief of staff, to make a phone call concerning what's going off of Bobby's sleeping head. Rupert lifts the phone, and there's Landry saying, would you mind telling me what's going off? Because we're getting reports of, you know, stuff overhead. Which, it's quite a phone call to get from a president, that is, you know, I must admit. And Rupert said, Landry said, what's the Air Force doing? And Rupert replied, if I know the Air Force, sir, he's serving captain, so he risked being censored here. The Air Force is doing nothing. He said that to Landry. Presumably Landry relayed it straight back to a rather bad-tempered and sleepless Harry Truman.
That's funny. There's nothing the Air Force could have done, Colin.
Well, you see, there were no fighters. There were usually some fighters at Andrews. But the F-94s had all been taken to, I think it was Delaware. Yeah. And they took hours to get there. This is Washington, for God's sake. And when they got there, of course, they had very little fuel. You know, we're dealing with somewhat restricted jet aircraft compared to today.
Right.
I don't think they had tanks. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But anyway, they didn't have any fuel. But they did see lights. And the radar of Andrews, the National Airport, locked onto the lights and vectored the aircraft onto the lights. And the lights seemed to be playing a cat and mouse game with the fighters, which I mean is quite frightening when you come to think. They were playing a cat and mouse game. They would swoop. They would swoop. They would swerve. They would accelerate to amazing speeds and then come down. The amazing speed was fantastic. An equal fantasy was the low speed, 50 miles an hour.
It was almost as if, Colin, they were trying to tell us, look, there's nothing you can do to stop us.
No. That's exactly what they were trying to say. Yes, exactly. Because the F-94s could do nothing. They were just like, you know, double-decker buses, as far as they could do nothing at all. They had loaded guns, of course, but they were forbidden to fire. The strange thing is that Ruppelt's book reveals a very deep level of thinking within American tactical intelligence here. In Britain, during the Second World War, of course, we developed the scramble philosophy. You know, the Germans were only minutes away. We had to have pilots sitting in the cockpits. They had to be vectored or standing air patrols all the time, vectored by radar onto the Germans. American Air Force thinking has had great difficulty with this. There should have been standing patrols over Washington, for God's sake, if only because it was Washington, and pilots in the cockpit standing by. The Americans were not alert in this sense, tactically alert to it. They were fetching these fighters from Delaware, and the poor creatures didn't have any petrol, jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing was a bloody fiasco. And, of course, they tried to cover this up, but the press got onto it immediately, and they brought out this amazing inefficiency as well as the UFO element. The capital's not defended.
Colin, was it just a one-night event, or did it happen over a period of the days?
It happened over a period of days. There were two significant weekends separated by 7 days. The first weekend, they phoned Ruppelt, get down here fast. And he was in Dayton, which is, 350 miles away, I think. And it took time to get there. Of course, he did. They didn't give him a great transport, you know, or money or means, this man. That he had to get there and sort this out with the Pentagon. And he got there, and after the press were screaming, after the Pentagon was panicking, and he said, well, I'm going to investigate this. They didn't give him any assistance. He didn't have a single assistant. On the Monday morning he arrived at the Pentagon, he read about the previous night's incidents in the press, the newspaper headlines. He was then tried to get a car to go around the bases. And he was told that nobody but generals could have cars. And it so happened that General Samford and General Garland were out of Washington at this time. And he couldn't get a car. And so they were, he was told to take the public transport. Yeah, he was told to take the public transport. And then when he filed for expenses, they were told him that he could only have a certain low amount of expenses. And he said, am I supposed to pay for taxis, buses, and a hotel room? Because the Air Force wasn't paying him. They didn't give him any accommodation.
Unbelievable.
Yes, unbelievable, yeah. And so he was left literally standing the Washington bus stops, crossing his fingers to try and get through the red tape of the various bases. You just couldn't walk into a military base or the National Airport. And he gave up in disgust he couldn't do anything.
The
Air Force weren't interested in him doing anything.
Did the episode, how did it end? Because I've never seen any accounts of that, Colin.
Right.
You know, what happened to the lights? How did they disappear? Did they go off into Never Never Land? I never heard that.
They went off into Never Never Land. Yeah, off the radar scopes, off the fighters themselves. The F-94 was a two-seat ship. It was quite advanced for its time. It was subsonic, not supersonic. And the rear pilot had his radar. And he got returns, and the National Airport got returns, and they locked on. And so you've got, you know, two-dimensional radar reference. Plus, of course, the folks in the streets, for goodness sake, they were they were reporting these orbs over the White House and taking photographs of them. And they heard the jets. This is what alerted Truman. It must have been a pretty disturbing experience for Truman, hearing, you know, this great noise of jets overhead. It's a non-flying space. No aircraft, not even a Cessna, is allowed to approach Washington in those days.
It's even worse now.
Yeah. And the whole thing caused tremendous rows. The Air Force, of course, it cast very bad light on the Air Force. The Washington wasn't covered militarily. So as regards the UFO thing, that's point A. As regards the military preparedness, point B, it caused eruptions within the Air Force. You're not defending the nation's capital. And they faded. Anyway, a week goes by. Ruppelt goes back to Dayton in disgust. He's the official UFO investigator. They won't help him. So he goes back to Dayton, Ohio, where reports are continuing to come in of enormous importance of UFO contacts and experiences, and shrugs his shoulders and carries on with his work. A week goes by, he gets another phone call. They're over Washington again. This time, he gets they give him a transport. He gets to the Pentagon, where all hell's let loose. You know, we're being attacked.
Yeah.
You know? And the assumption is that the scandalous thing was the newspapers pouring out. If these things, we don't know what these things are, but if these things should suddenly turn out to be, this is in the middle of the Cold War, of course, if these things should be, we're dead, to be Russian weapons, to be high Russian technology.
And I think that's one of the things they panicked about. They thought for a while these were indeed Soviet missiles or planes or something.
Yeah. People, non-technical people make rationalizations. You know, you couldn't possibly have a guided missile with a full tank of fuel over Washington from the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, there is a kind of scaling of events. They were in a very primitive state. But people are not technical. They're not rational in that respect. And they think, you know, these could be super technology, breakthrough in super technology, which they thought they might be, in which case America was dead if they had nuclear, if there were nuclear tips. What was the Air Force doing? Nothing. The intelligence dimension of the Air Force, in its ability to analyze these orbs over Washington, was pathetic. The second weekend, of course, it was decided by General Samford, the Air Force Chief of Staff, to have a press conference. So what do you do when there's a UFO invasion? You have a press conference. You die. Wonderful, wonderful. This is, absolutely. This is human beings in full space. That's why I like ufology. It shows human beings.
What did they say at the press conference?
Oh, the press conference. All the people who had reported the UFOs, who had actually seen them and been on radars, civilian and military, they were not present on the platform. It was a complete whitewash. Samford was a guy straight out of a John Wayne film. It was said of him that it was the kind of guy you wouldn't like to play poker with. He was a tough cat, and he just wiped the floor. These things are weather inversions. This was I'm giving it to you straight now. This
weather inversions show up on radar, chased by pilots.
Yes.
Weather.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Indeed. That's what I'm being very careful what I say here. That's what General Samford concluded at the press conference, the Pentagon press conference in 52. Yeah, that and he had guys, of course, backing him up on the same platform as all the press and the cameras were there. These are weather. This is temperature inversions. It's weather.
Do you
believe that?
Colin, do you know if other governments reported similar things during that year, 1952, or was it just us?
Oh, yes. No. They were British. They were very, very good British reports, and there were very, very good German and French reports, sound reports, yes, indeed. And the thing is, America being America, it has very, very good communications, you know, and it's a very powerful nation. And so America is, in other areas, you know, the one superpower. And it's because it's very good at media and so on, and because it's a powerful nation, the experiences are concentrated in America. Also, we don't speak French or German. And so you know, it's a British-American. My focus, of course, because I don't speak French or German, is American-British. Natural, you know, you have to accept that about human beings. But there were reports in Japan, for example, during the Korean War, and the reports of UFOs over Korea. And as the magazines and articles were written, it was found that it's quite a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, that's fascinating. When we come back at the top of the hour, Colin, let's talk about Charles Fort. He was a pretty interesting individual, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was he was native New Yorker, and he was I would say the world's first great ufologist. He wrote four books. The object of his life was to, it will relate to what we've been talking about in terms that he tells us about how human beings try to explain things. That's the connection of Charles Fort, what we've been talking about. He spent all his life finding out odd things, hairline cracks in the scheme of things, if you like. What we call today paranormal, oddities, things which are rare, like rains of frogs.
Let's talk about that when we come back, Colin. And, of course, Charles Fort, the magazine named after him, 40 in Times. We'll be back in a moment. We'll go live to the United with you and Colin Bennett, our guest. Colin, your book, one of them, of course, American Demonology. How'd you come up with that title?
Oh, this is my new book, released on the 29th of this month.
Mm-hmm.
I call it American Demonology because it's a book about Operation Blue Book and the official United States Air Force investigation into UFOs in the 1950s. Why did I call it an American Demonology? Well, in discussing difficult and controversial areas such as paranormal, etc., spiritual experiences, I always emphasize history. You know, we've had people in deserts see things. Our entire religious, Muslim religion, Christian religion, Hindu religion is based on meeting elemental creatures. I'm just asking people to consider the evidence here as far as culture is concerned, mm-hmm. pushing anything down their throats. It's a basic human response to what Jung called constellate a system. For the Greeks, it was gods and goddesses. For the Jews and the Egyptians, something else. And for the Romans, something else. And for medieval Christianity, it was the order of angels. There's always some higher constellation belonging to the gross physical aspects of life. Now, in our own age, it is my opinion that the military-industrial complex is such a constellation. It's part physical, it's part abstract, in the sense that we form many of our values from the benefits, if you like, or disadvantages of the military-industrial complex. It's what we refer to. We produce it, we live within it, and therefore it's a cosmological thing. In the sense we form our moral values, our intellectual values, from clever men and women who live in the military-industrial complex. We like its products. It's associated with consumerism and media. And this is our culture. And this is our cosmos. And now the Greeks had a word, daemon, which is a daemon, which didn't mean an evil devil in the Christian sense. It meant a spirit. The military-industrial complex is a spiritual dimension, or part of it, in which we live, whether we like it or not. Star Trek, for example, is a perfect example of the military-industrial complex extended into media, entertainment, mm-hmm. the belief system. So an American demonology is about a belief system. You can reject it if you like, but then if you want to reject it, you have to reject, say, Christ's miracles. Walking on the water, for goodness sake, you know. And feeding the 5,000, you reject those too. That's fine. You want to reject them, you reject them. But a culture is built around Christ's miracles. A culture is built around the miracles in the, described in the Quran. And so human beings build culture not around facts, but around miraculous or spiritual or mystical experiences. And they live within this, what you could call a continuum, to which they refer. And the military-industrial entertainment complex is a continuum to which we refer in turn. You know, millions of people worship Michael Jackson, for example. These are modern-day, it's the opinion of quite a few people, these are modern-day shamans. And so I called my book An American Demonology in the sense that Captain Ruppelt of Blue Book describes an entire the growth, of course, we're talking about early growth here in the 1950s, of not only a military-industrial complex, but a cultural complex to which people belong, to which they refer, and to which they form their values, with which they form their values. And that's why I call it an American demonology. It's nothing to do with the nasty devils from hell with hot tails.
All right. The perception of UFOs in your particular case, do you believe they're extraterrestrial from other planets or other dimensions?
Other dimensions.
Ah.
I appreciate the extraterrestrial concept of aliens, which many scientists believe in now. But according to relativity theory, the messages we receive, they're all dead. There are insuperable problems there. I think that quantum physicists, for instance, are now freely talking. Quantum physicists such as Jack Sarfati, Dr. Jack Sarfati, for example, is a friend of mine, are freely talking about interdimensional things. And so are people, very solid, very sensible people, such as Bruce McAbee, are talking about sure. quantum wormholes, entrances, and so on. And these are scientists, and they're beginning to open out the interdimensional aspects of alien contact.
Are they physical once they get here?
I'm sorry, George, would you say that again?
Are they physical once they get here? They're in shape and in craft? Physical structures?
So, yes, or partially physical, yes. The quantum worlds are very strange. I'm not a scientist. I'm an arts graduate. So, I'm speaking from the outside. But what I read about quantum speculations is that there are many, many aspects of being. And what could be inferred from this is that we see sometimes ghosts, etc., paranormal. We sometimes experience something of these transient quantum worlds. This is the current theory that's running among enlightened quantum physicists. The non-enlightened quantum physicists will think I'm talking nonsense.
Seeing you talk about ghosts, that leads us right back to Charles Fort,
yeah.
who had this incredible urge for the paranormal. And it became his whole life, didn't it?
It became his whole life, yeah. Detecting hairline cracks in the scheme of things. Things don't fit together. And you can apply a Fortean analysis, for instance, to the unsolved mysteries around the Oswald case.
And by the way, I want to talk with you later about this Oswald case because it's always fascinated me, and the fact that you're writing a book on it, I want to chat with you about that. But back to Fort.
Okay, now
Yes, and Ford's main idea was that you take a piece of experience. It could be hanging clothing on a line, on a washing line, and it breaks up when it's analyzed and analyzed and analyzed. It breaks up into anomalistic sections. The world is fundamentally unstable. There is a book called The Assassinations, which The Assassins, which came out a few years ago, and it's about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, here you have in this book a collection of 30 or 40 of very, very brilliant minds, top American journalists, scientists, speculators who know what they're talking about, who know what they're doing, or have all the information. They cannot put the 24-hour frame of Oswald's life into focus. So you have a crisis here in rationalism. That's what Charles Fort pointed out. You have all these brains, these resources. You try and put together a 24 frame of Oswald's life. And then the conclusion is that is this possible at all? I mean, Norman Mailer reaches the same conclusion in his book, The Oswald Tale. Here was something, and I'm quoting Norman Mailer here, beyond human can happen.
Something did indeed.
Yeah, that's Norman Mailer. And it sums up the Fortean point of view. You know, nothing could better express Charles Fort's point of view than that. Mm-hmm. That there is this central mystery which disappears rather like a mouse's tail into the floorboards.
Did Charles Fort, Colin, have any specific interest or expertise in the paranormal? Anything? Was it ghosts? Was it UFOs? Was it psychic phenomena? Was there any one thing?
It was the whole range. He wrote four books. The number one book is called The Book of the Damned. It was called The Book of the Damned because his idea was you have all these hairline cracks in reality, all these anomalistic question marks about the most basic experience, yet we produce a system of management and allowances. It's not fact versus fiction in Fort. This is he replaced the fact versus fiction equation, if you like, with a series of allowances. We allow the alien. We allow this. We allow that because we allow as much as we can handle, as much as we can take. Because if you lift the stone, you know, everybody in this world has lifted a stone in a garden at least once in their life. And you see what's underneath.
Can
you cope with that in human terms? No. So what you do is manage it. In the simple, brutal consumer sense, you deny it.
Do you think Hollywood has been basically told by governments, let's ease into the UFO phenomenon and let's do movies on things like that, Contact, and those kinds of approaches to desensitize us, to get us ready, or do you think it's just entertainment?
I think broadly that's true, but I would say that to Hollywood, put Hollywood in the best light, they have to do things that we like, things which are glamorous, sexy, exciting, and who's to blame them for that? I would be a terrible Puritan to blame them for that. If they use the latest speculations, latest UFO speculations, I think this is a somewhat healthy approach. There may be manipulation behind it. There probably is. But, you know, in a communist society, this disappeared. And human beings, you know, were almost suicidal with despair. We need this input. It's part of our makeup. The animals are not like this. Only this human animal needs this amazingly glamorous science fiction speculation, which we all groove on. We love it, and we consume it. It's, without it, I mean, imagine being without Hollywood and its range over the 20th century. You'd be a very miserable person if you rejected that. You would be a very miserable person if you rejected media entertainment. What kind of a person would you be?
Well,
it excites you.
Maybe more schooled.
I'm sorry?
Maybe more schooled,
yeah. Well, I mean,
I'd read more books.
Yeah, the thing is, from the moral point of view, I mean, when you didn't have Hollywood, when you didn't have media, the world was just as slaughterous.
Well.
The First World War was was created without extensive media involvement.
In your work, Colin, did you ever come across the work of the late journalist? Because I used to read his books too on ufology, and just I was fascinated with what he did. Frank Edwards.
Oh yeah, Frank Edwards. Yeah, he's a classic writer.
One of the best.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Sure. Absolutely. Yes. He was in from very early on, and his books were very, very sharp and brilliant and intelligent, and great loss. Really, we could do with Frank Edwards now. And he was very quick and astute. Yeah.
I think he was a believer, wasn't he?
Oh yeah. Oh sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. A lot of people are believers, mainly, if only, because of the simple fact that that they have experiences. I have had a UFO experience myself.
Tell me about it.
Well, fortunately, it hasn't happened before, and it doesn't happen again. It was about 25 years ago, I used to write plays, and I had a play on in a theatre in London. And I used to go to this play, see this play, just meet my friends, etc., during the week several times. On this day, the phone didn't ring, and it was a very strange feeling. And no one called, and I was living by myself. And I decided to go to the theatre to see my friends. And I got to the theatre, and I cursed myself because the theatre was closed. It was Sunday. I'm sorry about this preamble, but I got back to Notting Hill Gate, and I was still at a bit of a loss. And there was a film playing at the Coronet Cinema there. It was a kind of semi-pornographic film, and I decided to go in and see it. And I thought to myself as I sat there, am I getting to the age where I go into theatres alone?
Oh,
pornographic films. I thought, well, yeah. There we are. And I came out of the theatre. The film was terrible. And I bought some cat food, and I got to the railings outside my flat. As soon as I got to the railings outside my flat, I saw a bright light in the sky. It was evening, and late evening, and it went straight to the back of my head. If it had been pure candle power, I'd have been blinded. It was. It went straight to the back of my head.
And you sure it wasn't an airplane?
No. No, it was static. It was bright. It was moving very slowly. I then called down to the basement to my girlfriend, who lived in the basement, Karen, and I said, Karen, come and have a look at this. And she came out, and she was mounting the basement steps, and I thought, if she gets to the top of the steps and doesn't see what I am seeing, then I'll have to see a doctor or something. I never forget her face when she saw the thing itself. Well, a sense of relief came over me that someone else had seen it. We saw a truly fantastic thing. It's difficult to describe. I saw a Lancaster bomber static over Paris Square, and so did she. It was black. It was a Lancaster. It was static over there, as if it was suspended by a crane or something like that. This Lancaster bomber then morphed into a triangular craft and shot away. She was speechless. She was a very good witness. She was a very dour woman, a mathematics graduate, no, a physics graduate, and she was in shock. And we then saw another light, which was racing across the heavens, much smaller light than the first one. Out of this light came the first few cycles of a sine wave and disappeared, a light sculpting a sine wave. And the whole phenomenon disappeared. We then went down to her flat, and we were quite speechless. I was speechless because there was a man in black sitting there. I thought, oh, my God, in black.
That was fast, huh?
Yeah, it was fast, yes. The man in black was explained. He'd come to see a friend of his upstairs, and he wasn't in, and therefore he knocked on Corin's door to be admitted while he waited for this person. I've never known Karen open. She was not the kind of woman to open a door to anyone. He was a nice, friendly guy. Florid face, blonde hair, well-dressed, well-spoken, and very nice and very charming. He was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why his connection with the guy upstairs. And he sat there and said, I can see you're both in shock. I can see, I think I'll leave. I won't go see my friend now. And he disappeared. He made an excuse and left. And so we were there, and I said, I want to be alone. And she said, so do I. I went upstairs to my own flat. I took my cats in from the dustbin, went upstairs to my own flat, and bent down, giving the cats the food. And as soon as I straightened up again, I had a terrible shock. I'd lost time.
How much time?
I'd lost time. Yeah, I'd lost some time, yeah.
Hours?
I'd lost about half an hour.
Half an hour.
Yeah. I knew I had. I immediately leapt to the phone to try and catch the manager of the cinema. And I just called him before he went. And I said, what time is it? What time does that show come down? And he gave me the time. And I couldn't square the half hour. My journey from the cinema to the cat food buying to the railings. I'd lost half an hour. It was a tremendous experience in my life. I've never had anything like that.
Do you think you were abducted?
I've no idea about that. I didn't see any beings. And I've not been hypnotized, and I don't think I want to be. It wasn't a kind of, you know, creepy. It was experience from an SF dark horror film. It was quite cool. That was the frightening thing about it. You know, you could have a cool experience which doesn't include melodramatic elements, if you know what I mean. It was quite a cool, calculating experience. It was almost as if I was the subject of an experiment. It was nothing to do with the oobly-oobleys. And there we are, and I've written about that in the Phenomena magazine, and I got a tremendous response from it. And there we are. And people have these experiences, and particularly in the Betty and Barney Hill case, which is a classic case.
Oh, that is, it's got to be one of the best.
Yes, that's one of the best, indeed, yeah. And they reveal these things under hypnosis. And I believe in the reality of the hypnosis because the in their case, the simultaneous twin structure, you'd have, you know, two people from the same unconscious. I mean, that is a bit of a... That,
well, stay with us, Colin. We're going to take this break and come back, chat again. And I do want to ask you about Lee Harvey Oswald when we come right back. So what do you think UFOs are? Where do you think they come from? What's the reason? I'll take your phone calls next hour when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. But in a moment, our guest Colin Bennett. Let's chat a little bit about his investigation into the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. And welcome back to Coast, Colin Bennett, our guest. Colin, tell me why you started doing a book on Lee Harvey Oswald. Curious.
Well, it's one of the great subjects of the last century, and it ties in, rather like ufology, it ties in a lot of major areas. And Oswald as a character has always fascinated me. He's full of amazing question marks. He's almost straight out of the pages of a novel. As I said a few minutes ago, many books have been written to try and put a time frame, trying to clamp a system of reference onto Lee Harvey Oswald in the normal social psychological way, and all of them have failed to do so. It's very difficult to account for a single day of his existence. It's full of the most amazing anomalies and mysteries, as many as you can imagine. It's almost as if he's a living production rather than a human being. I mean, could you have anything more interesting than that? Also, as a person, he didn't have much going for him. He had a very, very elementary education and a very rather poor family background. His mum was loyal, but his father, I think, disappeared early. And he was a truant at school. He was obviously a bit disturbed. So he didn't have a higher education, and yet he just crashes through 20th century walls as if they didn't exist. The first thing he does is join the Marines when he was 17. And he was based in Japan. Now, here's the first mystery. In my researches, the lot of books blandly say that Lee Harvey Oswald was a radar operator in the United States Marine Corps based in Japan. And if you just take an elementary look at American Marine electronics courses, before you're allowed even in the same room as an operational television set, you will see that the years don't add together.
True.
People talk about Lee Harvey Oswald as if he's got his hands on a radar set guiding in U-2s, of all things, top secret aircraft then, and also B-52s full of nuclear stores. He's guiding them in. You would have to be a top sergeant of at least 10 years' experience before they let you do that.
But he was a good marksman, wasn't he?
He was an average marksman. He was an average marksman. Mm-hmm. Yes, he got a marksman's badge, but he wasn't incredibly brilliant, according to Marine records. However, okay, so that, I mean, that's the first thing, a mystery about Oswald. The time gap between radar training, the so-called radar training, hands-on important missions, no way that I can square. He would at least have had to an instruction period of at least 2 years. The radar course in the Marines then was 2 years. And then there was a 2-year apprentice course. Imagine, you know, crashing B-52s full of nuclear bombs because you gave a wrong direction. Oh, that's the most risky job in the world. They would never let him near it. Mm-hmm. Never mind a U-2. So there's the first mystery. You say, okay, well, there's something very strange here. And then the second thing is that he's talking communism all the time to his mates.
Yes.
In the Marine Corps. And studying Russian. And,
almost as if they wanted him to do that.
Yeah. There's always this amazing shadow, of other dimensions over him in all kinds of ways. It just doesn't fit. I mean, that's where you start with Oswald. And, of course, he leaves the Marine Corps. I think it was on compassionate grounds. And he doesn't want to be in the Marine Corps anymore. And then he joins the National Guard. The Marine Section, I think there's a Marine Section of the National Guard, I'm not quite sure, but he joins the National Guard, and he's given a dishonorable discharge because he doesn't turn up. His discharge from the Marines was not dishonorable, but his discharge from the Reserve was dishonorable. And he's talking communism all the time. And he then decides, of course, as we all know, to go to Soviet Russia. With all this knowledge, or no knowledge, of United States Marines radar, he takes off to Russia. His journey to Russia. All this is done without money.
Yeah, well, exactly. How did he do that?
He arranges everything. It's as if there's a tourist organization lifting him here, there, now from hotel to hotel, mind you. And he gets to Russia without any money at all. And, of course, in Lee Harvey Oswald fashion, he lodges himself into the biggest hotel in Moscow as if he's Mick Jagger on a tour, you know. He's presiding over a Rolling Stone concert. He behaves like a film star, you know, a big rock star. And so an amazing guy pulls it off. Who paid for the Hotel Moscow, it's called then? No one knows.
It's almost like he was either a double agent or a spy.
Or a spy, yeah. And the way he's carrying on, as I say, he's acting like a big film star lodging into a major hotel. And according to the bourgeois world, of course, he's nobody with nothing. So, but he's behaving like, as if he was, which is fine. Okay, I understand that. I have no problem with that. But how, the means of doing so are mysterious. Okay, he applies for Russian citizenship. Let's just remember that Russia in those days was a pretty stiff place. You couldn't mess around with the Russians, and yet he messes around with the Russians like nobody's business.
And getting away with it.
Yeah, he gets away with it, yeah. He should have disappeared, vanished, vaporized. He goes into a hotel, as I say, and then he hurries the Russians up. What about my citizenship, then? And the Russians are completely baffled by this American imp on their horizon, I think. They were hypnotized by him. What about my citizenship? And the Russians reply in after two or three days, which is slow for a Russian reply, you're not going to get Russian citizenship. Then he pulls a hat trick. He pulls a great star performance. He locks his door and he slits his wrists.
Well, now, I didn't know that.
Yes, oh, yeah.
He really slit his wrist.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Why?
Because he said that he was in despair, that they wouldn't give him citizenship. And he had an in-tourist guide there, very sensible woman, probably an Asian. Most in-tourist people were. And she's supervising him in Moscow. So he's not only got a Moscow hotel, he's got an interest agent, you know. The word agent indicates show business at all levels, you know. And she happens to go to call him, this hotel. And the door's locked. She's very suspicious. She calls security, and they batter the door down. There's Oswald, lying in the bathroom, covered in blood.
Almost dead.
Almost dead. They rush him to hospital, and they patch him up. And he's okay from then on. There we are. He's one star act.
So you don't think that was, well, do you think that was an act?
Well, I'm looking at, he might have died.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you're
within hours of death, yeah.
You've taken a chance on that one.
Yeah, if she hadn't called him, a very sensible, very stout kind of woman that the Russians employ on such missions, she sussed it, and they bashed the door down.
Do you actually believe, Colin, that he acted alone in the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
No.
No. Not, no. Not many people do anymore.
No. No, there was a framework. The thing is that it's always a mathematical problem to square the overall framework with the individual sectors. And this is everybody's big problem. Everybody knows this. There was a mafia involvement. There was a Cuban involvement. There was intrigues of all kinds. And criminal and varying shade of...
Yes, his interest. Personal life, everything.
It's personal, everything. And okay, you can perform. It's kind of a mathematical situation. You can have a mafia solution if you want. Then you can have a CIA solution if you want. And each separate solution gives you a solution, a partial solution, if you know what I mean. You can't sum the sectors.
Well, let's say this is how I look at things when they occur. I ask myself, who benefits? And then that's how you trace the trail.
Yeah.
In this
yeah.
particular case, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, who benefited?
Well, there's 1,001 books on 1,001 shelves which said that Johnson benefited.
Johnson, the industrial military complex that you talked about, they benefited because the Vietnam War just expanded and money was made there.
Yeah. This is the concrete solution. Yeah, I mean, but Kennedy himself, the bad blood came from Cuba. The bad blood came from Bay of Pigs, the betrayal of the Bay of Pigs.
Yes,
I never forgave him for that. There was the resources. There was a whole spectrum of resources which went into the Cuban exiles invasion, and he refused to give them air cover, as you know, from Guantanamo. Yeah, and from a carrier. And they were wiped out.
And they were expecting it.
They took a risk. They thought he would give them air cover, but Kennedy wouldn't give them air cover. And they landed, of course, without air cover, and Castro's forces wiped them out. And everybody lost a lot of money. A lot of money. Then, of course, there was involvement of the gangsters, Giancana and so on.
Who lost a lot of money in Cuba as well.
In Cuba. Oh, yeah, previously, too. Yeah. And they paid for the invasion forces, too, in private means. For Oswald is at the center of this. And as I say, he when he's in Russia, they put him to work in a radio factory. They send him to Minsk. And then he meets Marina. And they get together. They live. They get married. Or they have a child. And the serious thing is that his room, he has quite a nice apartment, which is most unusual. And he earns twice as much as anybody else, of course. In Oswald, yeah. And they give him a wage two or three times more than any other fellow worker's having. They give him an apartment, which is better than any other worker. Hmm. And he takes Marina, he marries her, they have a child in his apartment. This apartment, citing Norman Mailer here, and also Weber, or Weber, it's bugged. It's got cameras in it, it's got microphones all over the place. Norman Mailer has found the KGB transcripts of the Oswald Marina rows. They rowed often.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the KGB transcripts over in his book. And you can tell it's a kind of soap opera. He's, you know, that the people who say there was some kind of very deep psychological manipulation of Oswald on a new high-tech level would have to account for the time. He's rowing with Marina most of the time. And there's camera of them moving about in the room for months, and he knows a lot of people. And his hours at the Minsk factory and with Marina's friends are all accounted for. There's no big time gap in which you'd have to get hold, in which it was possible to get hold of him and manipulate him in the Manchurian candidate sense, you know.
Right.
I mean, the Manchurian candidate is a very good model for all this, but you had to get hold of him for a considerable long period of time, in theory, yeah. And nothing happened to Oswald like that. He led a perfectly normal row in which life in Moscow, in which he had normal human relationships, good, bad, and indifferent, with a lot of people. And so then, in the middle of this normality, he breaks it. Like he's showing, I hate to use these amateur psychiatric terms, but he's showing a certain kind of schizophrenia. Suddenly he decides he's had enough. And this is a wonderful star act. This is, you know, talk about petulance. The communist and Marxist suddenly decides that Russia is far too dull for him.
He's coming back home.
He's coming back home. And he shows a sense of humor in his diary. There's a diary. In which he says, if I go to another trade union dance, I'll scream. Isn't that wonderful? In other words, the dullness of Russian life did him in, finally. He wants Coca-Cola and all-night TV. And he wants to get back to America. That's one of the great star turn. And, of course, the great mystery is the Russians are tolerating all that. They say to themselves, oh, I see. He wants to go back to America. Oh, yes. Well, that's okay. What?
Yeah, I mean,
take a Russian woman?
So do you think he was a double agent or a spy from us spying over Russia? Who do you think he was?
The question, yeah, I'll answer that one, I think, just a second. The question of him being an agent of any kind is based on, you know, the good old pay dirt principle. What's the use of all this elaborate plotting and money and expense if he's getting no knowledge to you? He had no access to anything in Soviet Russia.
Unless he had a purpose.
Unless he had a purpose, but the purpose is certainly not giving information to American intelligence. I mean, what you got out of Oswald Rush's experience was that you worked in a factory. In a very conventional radio factory.
Do you think the Russians wanted Kennedy dead?
Well, this was Khrushchev's great era, and that is possible.
Yes.
Kennedy was a powerful man. He made them back down, and I don't think they ever forgave that.
I remember a theory, too, Colin, which was the strangest of all of them, that Aristotle Onassis wanted him out in order to get Jackie.
Yeah. I think there's that part of the intrigue, too, yeah. There's,
and maybe they were all in it together. All of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, Shakespeare would have painted this canvas. He would have brought them all in.
Yep.
I often, when I get confused about this thing, and you can often get confused with Lee Harvey, is to think about how Shakespeare would have seen it. And he would have seen this canvas, this amazing canvas. But there's very few 20th century characters have created such an incredible canvas as Lee Harvey Oswald. And the irony is at every point, he was never proved that he did anything in court of law. Never proved in a court of law that he did anything bad at all.
Well, he was gunned down. We never had a chance, I guess.
He didn't have a chance, no. But the gunning down, of course, that's the greatest, one of the greatest mysteries of all time. It's one of the great world's mysteries in the whole of history. His behavior was, Roswell's behavior seemed to indicate, and I'm going out on a limb here, I shouldn't say this, perhaps, is robotic, as if he is conditioned. He left the book depository when all hell was let loose in Dallas. He goes back to his bedsit rooming house. He's apart from, he's apart, he wasn't living with Marina at that time. She was taken in by Ruth Payne and the kid. They were impoverished, etc. He goes back to this rooming house and stays there for about 8-10 minutes. He then decides, in his wisdom, to go out for a walk in the middle of, you know, the whole of Dallas is exploding. He doesn't seem to be a part of it. He goes out for a walk. A patrol car comes up behind him, driven by patrolman Tippett. And Oswald turns and shoots him dead. It was along not a very frequented avenue, but they start ringing the bells. There's a policeman being killed. And so the whole of Dallas Police Department suddenly has that on top.
Mm-hmm.
Oswald then walks to the local cinema and goes in. Now, this is robotic, if you like. Goes into the cinema without buying a ticket. Can you believe this?
Yeah. Now, how do you do that?
How do you do that? He got in without buying a ticket. The manager... someone tells the manager, there's a guy in there, he's just walked in, he's not gone to the box office, he's walked in, he's sat down. The manager says, I'm going to call the cops.
When does this book, Colin, come out?
In about spring next year.
All right. That's going to be a fascinating one, too. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back with your phone calls with a question I shall ask you in a moment. Our guest has been Colin Bennett. Right here on Coast to Coast AM.